The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once spoke to a gathering of Unitarian Universalists, and he said to them, "There are some things in our nation and in our world to which I am proud to be maladjusted, and I call upon you to be maladjusted, and all good people, people of goodwill, to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. I never intend to adjust myself to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few and leave millions of people perishing on a lonely isle of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of prosperity. I must honestly say, however much criticism it brings, that I will never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism and to the self-defeating effects of physical violence. Through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daylight of freedom and justice." Before we sing our opening hymn, I'd like to invite the choir to come forward and share a song with us. The reading this morning is from this book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And the reading itself is a series of four brief anecdotes from the book. DiAngelo is an educator, and she's a diversity trainer and a consultant, and these four brief pieces represent some of her experiences as a trainer. I am a white woman. I am standing beside a black woman. We are facing a group of white people seated in front of us. We are in their workplace and have been hired by their employer to lead them in a dialogue about race. The room is filled with tension and charged with hostility. I have just presented a definition of racism that includes the acknowledgement that whites hold social and institutional power over people of color. A white man is pounding his fist on the table. As he pounds, he yells, "A white person can't get a job anymore." I look around the room, and I see 40 employees, 38 of whom are white. Why is this white man so angry? Why is he being so careless about the impact of his anger? Why doesn't he notice the effect this outburst is having on the few people of color in the room? Why are all the other white people either sitting in silent agreement with him or tuning out? I have, after all, only articulated a definition of race. In a cross-racial dialogue at an organization that is trying to increase its staff's racial understanding, the participants of color repeatedly challenge the problematic assumptions in a white woman's statements. "I feel like everything I say is thrown back at me," the white woman exclaims. "White people are being attacked and blamed, and we have to defend ourselves or just be punching bags. I give up. I'm not saying anything else." A board president has finally obtained agreement from the school to sponsor racial equity training for his predominantly white teaching staff. But when he hears the workshop's title, he backs away, not liking that the term white is used. And finally, I receive a call from a virtually all-white organization that is interested in racial equity training. They want to know how I will ensure that the participants will feel comfortable. There's so much in this book, which I've now reread carefully and slowly twice, that I found myself this week not knowing how to even begin to talk about it over the course of 15 or 20 minutes. I'll start at the beginning. After sharing the first anecdote related to her experience as a trainer on race and racism and diversity that I shared with you as part of the reading, Robin DiAngelo begins her book, White Fragility, with this powerful and provocative introduction. White people in North America, she says, live in a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race, and white people are the beneficiaries of that separation and inequality. As a result, we are insulated from racial stress, at the same time that we come to feel entitled to and deserving of our advantage. Given how seldom we experience racial discomfort in a society that we dominate, we haven't had to build our racial stamina. Socialized into a deeply internalized sense of superiority that we are either unaware of or can never admit to ourselves, we become highly fragile in conversations about race. We consider a challenge to our racial worldview as a challenge to our very identities as good, moral people. Thus, we perceive any attempt to connect us to the system of racism as an unsettling and unfair moral offense. The smallest amount of racial stress is intolerable. The mere suggestion that being white has meaning often triggers a range of defensive responses. These include emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and withdrawal from the stress-inducing situation. These responses work to reinstate white equilibrium as they repel the challenge, return our racial comfort, and maintain our dominance within the racial hierarchy. That, my friends, is a good summary of what DiAngelo later goes on to describe when she writes and talks about white fragility and the way that it functions. Hearing that extended quote may have brought up feelings for you. Hearing it may have raised questions for you. There is a lot in that statement on the first page of her book. And so this morning I'd like to try to begin to have us unpack it a little bit. I want to start by going back to 1963, when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He began that speech with a reference to the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, which freed millions of slaves. However, he said, 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. And he ended his speech by sharing his vision, which included these oft-repeated lines. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged by the color, not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that one day little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. Today, 55 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we still live in a society that is deeply separate and unequal based on race. If we really look, we can see evidence of this separation and inequality in our judicial system, in our prison system, We can see it in our medical system, in housing, in employment, in education. We can see it everywhere. Despite the passage of laws that are meant to bolster equality, racism is still pervasive in this country. For now, for this morning, I'm going to assume that we understand that our society, despite all that has been accomplished over the last 50 years, is still marked by this deep separation and inequality. Still, I know how many of us struggle with this word, racism. And I know that many of us struggle in understanding and acknowledging that we as white people are the beneficiaries of the separation and the inequality that do exist. So let's talk about racism. In 2019, racism still exists, but as D'Angelo points out, it has been wily and it has adapted. Before the civil rights era, it looked a lot like open hostility and legal separation. But as D'Angelo says, once the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, it became less acceptable for white people to admit racial prejudice. They did not want to be associated with the racist acts that they had witnessed on television, the police dogs, the fire hoses, the explicit violence. One line of King's speech in particular, she said, that one day he might be judged by the content of his character and not the color of his skin, was seized upon by the white public because the words were seen to provide a simple and immediate solution to the racial tensions. Pretend that we don't see race, and racism will end. So a couple of things happened as racism adapted itself to conditions. We learned not to talk about racism or race. We began to hide our prejudices instead of acknowledging them. And now we see evidence that suggests progress in terms of racial tension. We do see children, black and white and brown, holding hands, playing together. We do know that interracial marriage is now more accepted and more common than it was in the early 60s. We have developed a kind of colorblindness, and we've learned to better celebrate diversity. And so we say things like, I was taught to treat everyone the same, or I don't see color, or I don't care what color you are, or race doesn't have any meaning for me, or focusing on race is what divides us, you know. Or we say things like, I work in a very diverse environment, or I went to a very diverse school, or I have people of color in my family. Or we say, I was in the military, which is very diverse. Or I marched in the 1960s. Or I went to a very diverse college. And our understanding of the very meaning of the word racist these days has been reduced to what Robin DiAngelo calls a simple formula, which she describes in this way. A racist is an individual who consciously doesn't like people based on race and who intentionally seeks to be mean to them. So again, a racist is an individual, not a system, who consciously doesn't like people based on race, and it has to be conscious, and who intentionally seeks to be mean to them, and it must be intentional. That's what we've begun to learn it means to be racist. Well, as D'Angelo goes on to say, if that is our definition of what racist means, if that's the definition, then if you suggest that something I have said or done is in some way racist, that must mean that you think I'm a horrible person. And if you're calling me a bad person, of course I'm going to defend my moral character. Other people are racist, not me. We have othered the racist. That's what we've done. This is what D'Angelo calls the good-bad binary. Either one is a racist or one is not. Either one is a good person or a bad person. And she believes that this understanding of what racism is the root of virtually all white defensiveness when it comes to conversations about race and racism. This understanding of what it means to be racist is the root of why we as white people struggle to talk about racism. This is the root of why we have such strong emotional reactions when people of color or other white people try to talk to us about race and racism or challenge our assumptions or our behaviors. So often in those kinds of situations that I described in the reading, in the collection of stories, so often in those kinds of situations, we feel as white people singled out, attacked, silenced, shamed, guilty, accused, insulted, judged, scared, angry, outraged. When our behaviors are pointed out or our assumptions are called out, and feeling that kind of emotional reactivity, we respond very often by leaving, emotionally or physically, by withdrawing, or by arguing or denying, or focusing on our good intentions, because we're not bad people, or seeking absolution, or just avoiding conversation altogether. And in feeling that way, and in responding in that way to being called out, we make claims like, I know a lot of people of color, or I marched in the 60s, or you don't know me, don't judge, or you know, the real oppression is class, or gender, or anything other than race. Or we say, you're playing the race card. Or we say, I have suffered too. D'Angelo writes, we whites, who position ourselves as liberal, often opt to protect what we perceive as our moral reputations rather than recognize or change our participation in systems of inequity and domination. In my workshops, she says, I often ask people of color, how often have you given white people feedback on our unaware and yet inevitable racism, and how often has that gone well for you? Eye rolling, head shaking, and outright laughter follow, along with the consensus of rarely, if ever. And then I ask, what would it be like if you could simply give us feedback, have us graciously receive it, reflect on it, and work to change the behavior? Recently, a man of color sighed and said, it would be revolutionary. I ask my fellow whites, says D'Angelo, to consider the profundity of the experience, of that response. It would be revolutionary if we could receive, reflect, and work to change the behavior. In order to do that, we first need to come to a new understanding of what racism really is. Racism is not about an individual acting consciously and intentionally. Racism is structural, it is systematic, it is different from prejudice and discrimination. As D'Angelo describes it, prejudice is prejudgment about another person based on the social groups to which that person belongs. Prejudice consists of thoughts and feelings, including stereotypes, attitudes, and generalizations that are based on little or no experience and then projected on everyone in that group. Here's the key. All humans have prejudice. We cannot avoid it. People who claim not to be prejudiced are demonstrating a profound lack of self-awareness, she says. I'd like to invite you for just a moment to stop, take a deep breath, close your eyes if you wish, and take a moment to acknowledge some of your own prejudices. All right. Now, discrimination is action that is based on prejudice. So when the prejudice causes me to act differently, I am less relaxed around you, or I avoid interacting with you, I am now discriminating. Prejudice always manifests in action because the way I see the world drives my actions in the world. Everyone has prejudice. Everyone discriminates. If we had more time, I'd invite you to take a moment to reflect on the times in your life when you have discriminated in some way based on your prejudices. And as Meg said, we have an opportunity to continue this conversation after the service and after you have a chance to get some coffee. Now that, prejudice and discrimination, is not in itself racism. However, when a racial group's collective prejudice is backed by the power of legal authority and institutional control, it transforms into racism. Racism, as one Wesleyan professor has said, is a structure. Racism is a structure, not an event. Everyone has prejudice and discriminates, but structures of oppression go well beyond individuals. So here in our limited time is what we need to acknowledge. Racism is a system. We have all been raised within this racist system. We are, as D'Angelo says, swimming in it every day. It is unavoidable. And as a result of having been raised in a racist society, we all have a racial worldview and racial bias. That cannot be helped. And it is not something to feel guilty about. Also, we need to learn to acknowledge that that system is comfortable for those of us who are white, and there are ways in which it serves us. And we are invested in not seeing that, in believing that we have become who we are because of our own individual merits and achievements. The question in conversations about race and racism is not whether we experience racial bias. The question is whether we will acknowledge the existence of this system and the ways in which we benefit from it, and then if we will be willing to challenge it. Will we, as white people, truly keep our minds stayed on the freedom of those who experience inequality? Or are those simply words that we will sing? That work of dismantling, of interrupting racism begins with our being able to talk about it. Can we become more aware of our reactions when people of color or other white people challenge our assumptions or our behavior? And can we learn to respond in better ways to that feedback? Instead of becoming defensive and fragile, when we are given feedback on our inevitable but unaware racist patterns, might we instead learn to feel gratitude, excitement, discomfort, yes, guilt, perhaps, humility, compassion, and interest? Might we instead learn to respond with reflection and maybe apology and with further listening and processing, and with seeking to understand more, with grappling, with engaging rather than withdrawing? And will we learn instead to say, you know, I appreciate your feedback, or that's really helpful, or that's hard, but it's important, so I'm gonna think about it, or simply, oops, I have some work to do. Those simple responses are what that gentleman said would be revolutionary, and they would be a good place to begin in having our conversations. It's a lot to hold on to. It's a lot to grapple with. I'd like to invite you now to join me in a time of meditation followed by some quiet time to begin to sit with it. So if you'll join me in the spirit of prayer and reflection. Spirit of love and justice, we are grateful to be here together once again in this safe space dealing with things that make us uncomfortable. We gather this morning during Black History Month to remember the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the thousands of unnamed ones who put and who continue to put their bodies and lives on the line so that all may be truly free. We know that freedom comes at a cost, and sometimes that cost is our comfort. And we know that racism and homophobia and transphobia and ageism and ableism and sexism and classism, all of these unacknowledged realities, prevent us from being fully whole, prevent us from fully knowing one another, and from creating the beloved community spoken of by prophets. May the work inspired by the legacy of Dr. King continue to eradicate injustice wherever and whenever we encounter it. May we continue to speak out against injustice. May we learn to admit our shortcomings and to apologize for our failings, to speak even if we are afraid our words will not be heard or welcomed or perfect. May the spirit of Dr. King continue to inspire us, and may we be inspired by his dreams and his courage and his persistence. Now let us sit together in the quietness of this place. As we continue to engage in this work, may we also continue to learn to sit with our discomfort and to be mindful of our feelings. Sometimes freedom is a long time coming. It may take generation upon generation for justice to be won. Our Unitarian ancestor, the Reverend Theodore Parker, said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. From what I see, I am sure it bends toward justice." The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. added, "But here's the thing, it does not bend on its own. It bends because each of us in our own ways put our hand on that arc and we bend it in the direction of justice. The hands of Unitarian Universalists have been bending the arc for many years. Our hands, too, are needed for this work. May the bending continue until victory is won. Go in peace."